10 minutes after 8, let's check that WGTD sports and weather just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Major League Baseball, the All-Star Game tonight at Nationals Park in Washington, D.C. And in Northwoods League Baseball, the Kingfish hosts the Green Bay Bullfrogs tonight, 7:05 at Simmons Field. The forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny and pleasant. Today's high, 79. Now 72, Kenosha, 70 in Racine. Coming up on 8:11 for WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. July 17th, 2018 marks the 100th anniversary to the day of the brutal murder of the last Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, his wife Alexandra, their 5 children, and several loyal employees and servants. They were killed by Bolsheviks who were in the process of trying to consolidate their hold over Russia after forcing the Tsar to abdicate a year and a half earlier and capturing both him and his immediate family. We are marking the occasion of this dramatic moment in world history with an interview with best-selling author C.W. Gortner, whose latest book is a magnificently crafted historical novel titled The Romanov Empress. The novel explores the remarkable life of Maria Feodorovna, who was the wife of Tsar Alexander III and the mother of the aforementioned Tsar Nicholas II. Born in 1847, she actually outlived her son and his family by more than a decade, having managed to escape the chaos of Russia after the revolution to live out her final years in her native Denmark before dying in 1928. She was actually known in her youth as Princess Dagmar of Denmark, although everyone close to her called her Minnie. C.W. Gortner's novel begins with the impending wedding of Minnie's older sister Alex, who had agreed to marry Albert Edward, the Prince of Wales, who would eventually become the future King Edward VII of England. Young Minnie, in this scene, cannot understand how her sister could possibly agree to marry a man whom she barely knew and certainly did not love, at least at that point. Ironically, Minnie herself would be part of such a politically arranged marriage just a few years later. There are all kinds of fascinating figures of history who come to life in this remarkable novel, not least of which being the most formidable figure of Queen Victoria.
This is a time where Victoria had sort of ensnared, Queen Victoria had sort of ensnared most of the royal houses into this web of marital alliances. It was the way that these dynasties sort of cemented their international standing and kind of influenced. So for someone like Minnie, it was sort of inevitable that it was going to happen. But all the evidence points to the fact that she was not happy about it. But it definitely, you know, was part of the royal sort of the royal mandate that you married for the best of the country and you married for the best of the position. And if love sort of happened during the marriage, that was fine. But if it didn't, then, you know, it wasn't to be expected, in other words. But her parents had a love match. So her example was different. The example she'd had growing up was different. So it was a difficult position she was in. And then, of course, she does fall in love. So that was sort of the irony of it all.
Absolutely. I also appreciate how you describe for us a meeting, and I suspect that we maybe don't know for certain that such a meeting took place, but perhaps it did, between her and none other than Queen Victoria, who this is when Minnie is there for her sister's wedding, and Victoria has in mind the possibility of perhaps Minnie also marrying into Victoria's family, and this is something to which Minnie is a bit resistant and in a sense politely resists. And at one point you have Queen Victoria saying, "You have spirited, you have spirit. I was once a spirited girl, too spirited, some might say." So you're suggesting that that this young princess from Denmark, still a teenager, in a sense managing to hold her own opposite Queen Victoria, that would suggest that there was at least a bit of personality that the two of them shared.
Well, we know that Victoria, I mean, the time we meet Victoria in the book, she's older, she's in deep mourning over the premature loss of her husband. But we know that as she is a young girl, Victoria was quite spirited. And, the evidence is there, all the historical evidence is there, is that she was definitely very strong-willed. And so I wanted these two women to meet each other. There's no evidence that they actually met alone. And this is where the crevices of what I talked about earlier, where historical fiction fits so nicely into the crevices of history. But Minnie was definitely in England at the time for her sister's wedding, and it's quite likely that they spoke. And there is plenty of historical evidence that Victoria was indeed considering having Minnie marry her younger son, Alfred, who had expressed interest in Minnie because of her appearance at the wedding. And Minnie was, of course, completely not interested in doing that. But one of the main things that Victoria probably would have been trying to do would have been preventing Minnie from marrying the Russian heir. She may have caught wind at that point that there was some talk in that arena. Britain and Russia were often at odds with each other, and Victoria had no love for Russia. So she would have tried to have prevented any sort of advantageous marriage for the Tsar's children. And at that point, in Victoria's eyes, the fact that Minnie's sister had married into her family suddenly elevated the Danish royal family to a position where she had to take note and sort of control who was marrying who. It was very much Victoria's style to control who married who, and she became very unhappy when people disobeyed her or ignored her. So I thought that scene was very fitting. And sort of reflective of what happens to someone like Victoria, a queen, when you lose someone very close to you. She lived a very isolating existence despite all her privilege.
Well, Minnie, of course, eventually does meet the future czar of Russia, the man who is expected to one day be the czar of Russia, and quite unexpectedly, very much falls in love with him. I mean, despite all of her expectations that such a thing could not possibly happen, in fact, it does. And then, of course, events change that make it not possible for the two of them to be married as they plan when this young man, Niksa, is killed in a riding accident. And Minnie ends up marrying his brother Sasha instead, and it is an uneasy beginning to their marriage, which eventually evolves to a actually much happier place. Tell us about the challenge of trying to tell this story as you do, and of trying to take us inside sort of the emotional life of these two people who find themselves unexpectedly thrust together.
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges for me for writing the book was trying to figure out, what we get in nonfiction oftentimes is a description of the happenings and the events. But what the challenge for me was to try to find their emotional core, was to try to find out who these people were, how they may have felt about the situation. I mean, Minnie did very much fall in love with Nika, the Russian heir. There's plenty of evidence of that. There's letters that have survived between them that indicate a really deep attachment. So to suddenly lose him the way she did and then sort of be obliged to marry his brother, who by all accounts was very different from Nika in personality, was much gruffer and and far less polished because he wasn't expected to inherit the throne. He was the son, you know, sort of the spare. And the Tsar had several sons. I had to try to work hard to figure out, do a lot of research to figure out how it would have felt for these two people to suddenly find themselves joined in marriage where they basically didn't know each other at all, where Minnie is basically in mourning for the man she did love and was thinking of marrying. And Sasha sort of obliged to take on this bride that he really never planned on. So that was a challenge to do, I needed to find out their emotional core while keeping into account that these are not people like us. These are royal people who sort of, despite all their hopes and dreams and or their rebelliousness, sort of know in the back of their mind that they are going to be expected to wed for the good of the country and to put up with it and make the best of it. I mean, the events turned out to be, their marriage turned out to be quite loving and deeply loving, but it had a rocky start. And so, you know, I wanted to be faithful to that. The challenge of the book in general is that, you know, I'm covering a lot of ground. A life is full of infinite details, I love to say, and a novel is finite. I only have so many words. So I had to really pick and choose sort of the events to focus in on, to develop these characters and make them come to life. And of course, it's a large cast of characters.
Right. And of course,
very larger than life characters.
Of course. And in a sense, one of those characters is Russia itself, because one of the things that that Minnie is experiencing is not only marriage to someone she never expected to have to marry, but she is also being taken from her own beloved Denmark to this far-off exotic land of Russia. And she, at least part of her, dreads the thought until she arrives there and finds it a strange and wondrous place. Explain just a little bit about what she would have seen and heard and experienced in first arriving at Russia that would have made it such an overwhelming and splendid experience in so many ways.
Well, she sailed into St. Petersburg. So, you know, St. Petersburg is a beautiful city. Peter the Great had very much westernized. He moved. Peter the Great was very influenced during his travels by the Western world, and he wanted to make the Russian court much more westernized in its approach, which is the court that Minnie eventually steps into. And he also wanted to build a new capital. So he moved. He broke with precedent and moved the capital of the country to St. Petersburg, which he built on swampland. So it's sort of like a Venice. It's built on islands with lots of canals. He built it in the latest styles. You know, it has this incredible, there's a lot of color to the buildings. The buildings are all painted these different sort of pastel or eggshell colors. It would have been for many a truly wondrous sight, a city, you know, that was seen to float on water, especially at that time of the year when, you know, it's constantly daylight. And it would have been quite magical for her. We have to remember that though these people were royal, especially someone like Minnie, she hadn't traveled very much due to the cost of travel and just the fact that many of these royal people, the boys were always sent out on continental tours when they reached a certain age, but the girls never were. So for her, it would have been quite overwhelming to see something like that, so different from what she was accustomed to seeing. And yet, you know, there was a familiarity to it because you don't see the onion domes or some of the other things that you would have seen in Moscow because Peter the Great, you know, eschewed all of that. He built a very Western-looking city. It would have been, I think it would have been an amazing sight for her.
Right. And of course, one of the things that she was experiencing was also being forced to convert from her own religion, which was Lutheranism, to the Russian Orthodox faith, and having to adapt herself to all kinds of unfamiliar practices. In fact,
right.
One telling detail is that for her own wedding, that the process of robing her in her bridal attire took, in her words, 3 excruciating hours. I mean, just to get into all of the heavy, ornate finery which she had to wear to her own wedding. That, in a sense, is such a wonderful metaphor for what she was experiencing in this dramatic life change.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Russian court, they spoke French more than Russia, English or French more than Russian. And it was very Western in sort of its customs and its manners. But it had this overlay of this ancient, you know, Slavic tradition that had been handed down from generations. For example, the Romanov brides could only use one mirror, the mirror that Peter the Great's daughter had used. So they could only be dressed in front of this one mirror, and they had to have these specific side curls that had been made popular by Catherine the Great. And then all of the different layers of the bridal costume were all heirlooms handed down by generations, including this massive crown that was composed of two interlocking layers of jewels. So, you know, for many, that's sort of a symbol of everything that's to come, because she, you know, as I described the wedding in detail, I think because I wanted people to see, you know, not only was it how she had addressed, but how she had to receive people, how she was expected to behave. There was a very strict etiquette overlaying the way the court acted. And there were huge expectations placed on her shoulders almost immediately. What's so wonderful about Minnie, or remarkable about her, is how she rose to the occasion. She definitely, you know, decided that she was going to conquer this sort of overwhelming situation she was in. She spoke very little Russian. You know, in the haste to get married, there was a traditional time for the heir to the Russian throne's marriage that they had to meet. So she really didn't have a lot of time to learn what she needed to learn. She sort of was tossed into it, and I think she did quite well, all things considered.
To say the least. We're speaking with C.W. Gortner. We're talking about his magnificent novel called The Romanov Empress, a novel of Tsarina Maria Feodorovna. We often hear, especially when we're hearing about an actual story being adapted for the silver screen, about poetic license. And we've already touched on the fact that in the way you've crafted this novel, you are, in a sense, imagining conversations that nobody was in a position to overhear, and in a sense, assigning very specific words and feelings and so on to this woman and those around her, based on your best understanding of who they were and how they would have reacted to the events that unfolded in their lives. That being said, somebody crafting fiction might go a step further in this thing we call poetic license and, for instance, fashion characters out of thin air, or maybe consolidate multiple characters into one, or in some other ways reshuffle the events of history to make them flow in more dramatic fashion. You know what I'm talking about. I am assuming that your novel does not involve any of that kind of poetic license, or if it does, very little. The sense is that what we are reading here very much springs from the historical record.
This is my 10th historical novel. I try to never deviate from the established historical record. In other words, you know, if something happened, it happened. I can't change the outcome. I can't change the way it happened. If my character was at some place at a certain time when it might have been more convenient for the story for her to be somewhere else, I can't change that. Where the record is open to interpretation is how the character reacted to the event, unless there's a documented instance of the character reacting in a complete, you know, in an established way. You know, your freedom as a novelist is to figure out how the character might have reacted based on your best understanding of how that character is and was. So, in other words, let me try to take an example. The way Maria Fyodorovna reacts to her daughter-in-law, Alexandra, which it seems to have come up quite a bit amongst readers, sort of this surprise that they didn't get along at all. There's a lot of the historical record. There's quite a bit of information in the historical record to indicate that Alexandra and Maria Fyodorovna did not get along, that Maria never wanted Nicholas II to marry Alexandra, that she felt she was unsuitable to be Tsarina, and Alexandra's behavior kind of cemented Maria's position. So in that instance, you know, all I needed to do was dig to find the information. I never create characters out of thin air. Everybody that I put in my books actually existed. The only exception would be, for example, A Lady in Waiting, where I only have a name, somebody that traveled with the character, but you can't find any information on them. But again, you know, I'll use very judicious research to figure out how other Lady in Waitings in the same position would have behaved, and then try to craft the character based on that. In Maria's instance, that really wasn't necessary. Everybody was pretty well documented. I try to take as little fictional license as possible in following the record. Part of the joy for me of writing historical fiction is figuring out how the character reacted to what we know and crafting a character based on what we know. It's a challenge because oftentimes you don't agree with what your character is doing, or you don't agree with how your character thinks or how she behaves. But that's part of the joy of writing historical fiction for me, is that it's not about me, it's about the character. Hmm. Does that sort of answer your question?
Very much so, and that's certainly my sense as I read your novel, but it's good to hear that confirmed, that although this is, in one sense, a work of fiction, it is a fiction very deeply anchored in the historical record, and you have attempted to be as true as one can possibly be to the historical record while writing in the form of a novel.
Exactly. I mean, if you read a lot of nonfiction, which you say you do and I do as well, because I have to for my research, I mean, I'll find in two different biographies of the same character conflicting information. Nicholas II is a really good example of that. I mean, he's a controversial figure, and there are very different interpretations of his personality and the kind of ruler he was. So part of my challenge as a writer is to look at all the, whenever the accounts are different, I have to look at the character based on what I know and what is established and is not being debated, and then figure out, well, which interpretation seems the most likely based on his personality or how he behaved or what happened. The historical record isn't always completely factual. I mean, history is written often in hindsight, and so I have to be cautious about that. But at the same token, I can't just, take flights of fancy and decide that I'm going to do whatever I want because it's more convenient for my story.
Hmm. So at this point in time, Minnie has just become married to Sasha, the brother of the man she had intended to marry and who, of course, tragically was killed. And the story of this marriage is, of course, one of the most intriguing chapters in the entire book. At one point, she is asked, do you love Sasha? And she replies, I will. It is my duty as his wife. And of course, that is part of what their story is of learning to love one another within the bonds of matrimony. On what do you base sort of the emotional truth of their relationship? Or is this the kind of thing where you are kind of left to your own supposition and imagination?
Well, again, going back to what we spoke about previously, I have to look at what was established. So it was established that she had fallen in love with Sasha's brother. They were engaged to be married. Sasha's brother had a fall from a horse that precipitated spinal meningitis. Minnie was summoned urgently to his bedside, where he made her promise. He tried to extort a promise from her to marry his brother Sasha, that he had failed her in a certain way. It's uncertain, it's unclear about whether Minnie actually made that promise or not, but Sasha certainly did. We also know from the record that Sasha gave up a mistress that he had in order to prepare himself for the marriage. So when I put those things together, and just taking into account the fact that, a young woman who has been madly in love and who's fiance has died suddenly and tragically, it's certainly not going to be inclined to fall in love quickly with someone else. And Sasha and Minnie were married within the year and a half of Nika's death. So I tried to put together that, and then the fact that Sasha gave up a mistress, that these were two people who definitely were not in love. They married for reasons of duty. I believe Sasha, based on his character, took his promise to his dying brother very seriously. And I think that it took them some time to find common ground in the marriage. A lot of times these arranged marriages, just they were always arranged. They never reached any level of passion or love. But it, later on, the record shows that Minnie and Sasha became very close and were very devoted to one another. And lots of people remarked upon it. There's many accounts, written accounts of the Romanov court, where you see them through other people's eyes. And to all intents and purposes, they appeared to be very much in love. So, you know, again, as a novelist, I deduced, well, it probably took them some time to get there. It didn't happen overnight, right?
Sure. It makes perfect sense, and feels very authentic the way you have told it. So when Minnie, now Maria, marries Sasha, Sasha's father is the Tsar of Russia, Tsar Alexander, and this is an extremely turbulent period in Russian history, with nihilists about who are intent on toppling the monarchy, and. It's hard to understand, given what Tsar Alexander had done for the Russian people. Can you help us explain the kind of complicated political reality in Russia at this point in time?
Yeah. Well, Alexander II was known as the Tsar Liberator. So basically what he did was he liberated the serfs, which had been under a very archaic medieval system of sort of servitude, a form of bondage to landowners, and he liberated them from that. But he didn't put in place any sort of system to replace the system the serfs had lived under. So suddenly these people who were basically serving landlords and giving a great portion of their crops to landlords found themselves without the land, because they were no longer in servitude to the landowners, so the landowners were taking back the land, were obliged to pay in order to be able to farm on the land, had to find ways to get their crop to the market because there was no longer that system in place. Many of them were very uneducated, illiterate. You know, suddenly they were cast adrift. Alexander II, it was a remarkable thing that he did, and he was really highly praised for it. But the system, which I think I explained part of this in the book, it wasn't in place to receive this influx of people who suddenly needed a way to make a living. And we're also talking about sort of the end of the 19th century. We're beginning to enter the 20th century. So the book is as much about these people as it is about the clash between sort of the established systems of the 19th century clashing with sort of the upheaval of the 20th century. It's no coincidence in the early 20th century, three royal houses fell in Europe, not just the Romanovs, as a result of World War I. So the nihilists were this sort of nebulous anarchist group that followed a certain philosophy of chaos. They are the precursor of the 1917 revolution. We tend to think of the 1917 revolution as sort of this isolated sudden event that deposed the Tsar and suddenly Russia was communist. But in fact, the revolution was the inevitable result of many years of dissension and agitation against imperial rule. And the nihilists were sort of the beginning of that. They were very loosely organized, if organized at all. They really didn't have a common sort of goal or common leader. They sort of just struck at random. And part of their motivation was the fact that there was this influx of peasantry coming in from the countryside seeking work, seeking a way to stay alive. And they were being hired at the new factories that were being built all over Russia with the beginning of the industrial age. And they were being exploited in the factories even worse than they'd been exploited by landowners. Sort of their whole way of life had been overturned with this emancipation. And the anarchists kind of used that as a foundation for saying, well, this is, you know, the reason why we don't need a czar. Well, we need to self-rule. Tsar Alexander II is quite a remarkable czar and very worthy of study in his own right. much of the previous Romanovs are overshadowed by the downfall of the house, but Alexander II was a remarkable man. But, you know, people of in that highest place of privilege, without parliaments, without sort of the checks and balances on the autocracy that Russia didn't have, he sort of didn't have the foresight to think, well, you know, if I liberate these people from the servitude to landowners, what am I going to do? How am I going to take care of them? And so that was the inevitable result, that he wasn't able to do it. It's really not that complicated when you break it down like that. But it was a very complicated situation in Russia, because suddenly something that he had done to benefit the country had turned against him.
Exactly. I think that's the rub, that where at a glance it makes no sense. And then you just look a little closer, as you said, sort of take it apart, and it makes perfect sense, the kind of trouble that engulfed him.
Alexander explains this to many, where he explains that he didn't think, that he didn't foresee that it wasn't enough to just liberate the serfs, that he needed to take further steps. There was a lot of resistance to his rule amongst the aristocracy and his own family, because they felt that what he was doing was dismantling, 300 years of tradition of an autocracy that had ruled supreme over Russia.
Right, and so even his own siblings viewed with great disdain what Tsar Alexander was doing.
The Grand Duke Sasha himself, his son, reacted very adversely to his father's actions, because it was threatening. It was threatening to the established order.
Of course, explain the rupture between the Tsar and Maria, his daughter-in-law, and how that rupture was eventually repaired, at least to some extent.
Well, without giving too away of the novel's plot, basically Sasha opposed Alexander's further decisions to what to do to sort of deal with the turmoil in the country, which involved the nihilists and the serfs being exploited in the factories. Sasha opposed it greatly. To him, it was a breakdown of the autocracy, and there were three pillars to the autocracy that needed to be upholded. So Sasha and the Tsar ended up, and Sasha was the Tsar's heir. He was destined to succeed him, became estranged, also over personal family matters, when the Tsar remarried. So between all of this, they just became completely estranged. They didn't see eye to eye. They never really had. So again, this is part of what the novelist has to work with. If you look back at their history, Sasha was never destined to be the heir. His older brother was. And so the father and son had never really gotten along. And so this was just added fuel to the fire. And it put Maria in a very awkward position, because she had a very good relationship with her father-in-law. And in many ways, all indications are that she sort of secretly approved of these changes being done in the country. She felt, again, she came from a country, she was born in a country where the monarchy was already constitutional. So to her, it wasn't that outlandish. So eventually Maria worked her magic, which was basically she was very socially adept and managed to organize a luncheon between Sasha and his father so that they could discuss what basically was going to happen. I mean, the Tsar had already made a decision, and one that Sasha was certainly not going to like. But Maria felt it was very important that they talk about it face to face before it was announced. Whenever the Tsar made decrees or decided to make changes, it was published in what was something called the court circular, which was sort of like a newsletter that went around to the aristocracy, sort of announcing these proposed changes. And then it was many times those advanced copies of that circular were given to newspapers to be published formally so that the public could be aware of. So many wanted all of the stuff that was going to happen to not She didn't want Sasha's first experience of it to be the court circular or the newspaper. She wanted the Tsar and his son to speak face-to-face. Unfortunately, the meeting never took place.
This is a very violent period in Russia's life, and you describe in really quite graphic detail what it was like to experience bomb explosions, assassination attempts, and so on. And in the aftermath of one of the most serious assassination attempts on the Tsar's life, you have Sasha telling his wife, we mustn't show them any fear. I forbid it. And it's just so interesting to think about, human beings caught up in such terrifying events and yet feeling, at least to some extent, as though fear is something that that they cannot afford to show, at least outwardly, even if you might inwardly feel it to the core of your being. It one can't help but pity anybody who finds themselves caught in that kind of scenario.
Right. Well, you know, again, it was Sasha, and again, that's held up by the historical record and how he conducted his reign. Hmm. You know, how he conducted, the way he oversaw Russia was, he was quite fearless, and he was called tyrannical,
right,
by many, and with good reason.
Right.
But he just would never. He had sort of that stiff upper lip thing, but he also had a great temper. He was famous for his temper. For getting extremely mad at advisors and shouting at them, and not a man to be trifled with.
No kidding. So, as perhaps our listeners already know from the historical record, Tsar Alexander is killed in one of those bombing raids, shall we call it, is assassinated, yeah. And Sasha becomes Tsar Alexander III, and Maria is the Tsarina. One of the most poignant moments in this portion of the book is how you describe the family living for a time in something called Arsenal Hall, because it would be easy to defend if they were to be attacked. And so this is how the reign of this new czar and his tsarina begins, under that cloud of imminent threat. It's hard to imagine what that would feel like.
Well, it's the end of the Winter Palace had sort of been the center of court life since Peter the Great, when he moved his capital to St. Petersburg, and the Winter Palace became the center of the court. This is the end of that. We don't see, again, a czar living full-time in the Winter Palace. Because of the assassination of Tsar Alexander II, Sasha, his son, took a very different approach. He truly believed that the country could not be trusted, but with good reason. I mean, his father was blown apart. And the way I described the bombing is the historical record. It's exactly what happened. So Sasha moved them outside to a fortress palace that had been basically a neglected hunting preserve, a place where the czars went to do some hunting. And he just refused to let the family returned to St. Petersburg for a period of time because of this fear, because these assassins had struck so brazenly and so suddenly. These new sort of nitroglycerin bombs that could be handheld and flung, you know, were very hard to evade. So we see the end of the Winter Palace being a center of court life for a period of time. Eventually, things, you know, quieted down enough that they would return on occasion and they held palace events and stuff like that. But it was never the full-time residence of the Tsar again. And of course, under Sasha's son, Nicholas II, they went even further and basically didn't use the Winter Palace at all.
Mm-hmm. You have at one point Sasha saying, "Russia is unworthy of our trust." He's in the midst of kind of describing or justifying some of the measures that he took to exert a very, very firm control over just about every facet of life. And in some ways, one has a sense that legacy lives on, that other rulers and leaders in subsequent decades, in a sense, are echoing some of these measures taken by Tsar Alexander III.
Yeah, well, you know, Tsar Alexander III is an interesting character, and I was fortunate to find a biography of his written by a scholar. There's not a lot written about him that's available in English. He was, you know, despotic and anti-Semitic, and there were a number of ugly traits in him. But he basically had decided that the country was going out of control. So what he tried to do was rein it back to a time before, which, you know, was sort of like trying to stem a tidal wave. I mean, there was so much change occurring in the world. It was very unlikely that he was going to be able to hold on to the changes he did. But he did a remarkable job of sort of holding his own throughout his reign. And it's interesting to speculate what would have happened if he hadn't died as young as he did.
Of course.
Would the revolution have ever taken place? you know, what might have happened if he had lived to a ripe old age.
Right.
And it does echo sort of the censorship of the press and sort of the things we hear happening in Russia now. You know, he was not a believer in democracy. Sasha was not. that's quite obvious.
Right.
And he wasn't a believer in parliaments or any of that. He believed in the Tsar's firm right to rule, a divinely appointed right to rule. But unlike some of his predecessors, he also felt he had a great responsibility to the country. So under him, a great number of hospitals were modernized. He reduced the incomes of the family significantly, which basically angered everybody. He poured a lot of his effort and time into bettering the country. He did a lot of international alliances, promoting Russian trade, Russian artists. He really, in that aspect, he was very much a hands-on ruler and to be admired for those particular actions, even if some of his other ones are not so admirable.
Right. And Maria, of course, is to be admired as well for much that she did as Tsarina. As you said, he dies young, just 49 years old in 1894, and this thrusts their son into the position of Tsar, in a sense, prematurely, most would say, before he was ready. We have just a very brief time to just touch on actually how complicated the story is from here of Maria living on and, in fact, outliving her son, Tsar Nicholas II, who, of course, is deposed and eventually murdered along with the rest of his immediate family. Just maybe tantalize our listeners with just a hint of just how complex the story of Maria is from this point on.
Well, you know, you're looking at a woman who's older. She's not the same woman. A woman who's, you know, been in Russia for over 40 years, has lived, first of all, as sort of the Tsarvena, which was the wife of the heir apparent to the throne, and then a woman who stood at her husband's side for 13 years as the Tsarina and oversaw the apartment. At one point, the department of the Empress Maria, it was called, had over 300 institutions under its command, hospitals, orphanages, educational centers, and Maria oversaw all of that. To suddenly finding herself as the Dowager Empress. Now, in Russia, the tradition for the Dowager Empress was that she had precedence at court over the Tsarina. So Maria had that position, and they were able to retain much of the possessions that they had as far as the palaces and rights to the yachts and their private train and all that. But she suddenly found herself basically demoted. And in her position, in her place, was Nicholas's wife, Alexandra, you know, a princess that Maria had never wanted her son to marry and that she felt was going to be very inadequate for the challenge, which turned out to be true. So suddenly she's facing sort of a significant change in her life. She and Nicholas were very close. Nicholas was not close to his father. Nicholas never really wanted to rule. In fact, I think there's a part in the book where he states as much, and it's based on the record. His cousin, who was married to his sister Zenya, they were very close friends. He reported it several times to Nicholas and said he never wanted to be Tsar. And it's borne out by his reign. He was much weaker than his father and much less capable of facing the challenges that he did. And he had at his side a wife who was extremely difficult, extremely neurotic, very antisocial, you know, basically reclusive. And her decision to move the family outside of the city to live permanently at the Alexander Palace in the countryside really hampered Nicholas's ability to sort of keep an eye on things, to keep in tune with what was going on in the empire. And Maria, in the meantime, is finding herself being distanced from her son because he turned more and more for counsel to Alexandra. He sort of welcomed this nucleus family that they created with their children and his wife, where Maria, basically she had to be invited to visit.
Hmm.
She wasn't really allowed to drop in. So, you know, Maria faced a very difficult time. And in the meantime, you're watching the country grow more and more chaotic, more and more trouble happening as Nicholas refuses to implement some of the changes that his grandfather had wanted for the country and Maria had espoused. Those changes, of course, were put on hold during Sasha's reign. But with Sasha gone, Maria again had entreated her son to do it, to allow a constitution, to allow a parliament, to scale back the autocracy. I think on many levels she sensed that her son was not going to be able to handle the full responsibility of being a czar like his father had been. But I also think she knew that the world was changing and Russia had to change with it. Unfortunately, Nicholas did not see it that way.
Right, or did not understand exactly what those changes represented or how to enact them.
He did eventually enact parliament, you know, the Duma, but it was a disaster. In my book, I couldn't go into detail over the various Dumas and their collapses, so I tried to. There's one place where I did encapsulate, because it's very complicated politically for someone who doesn't understand sort of the intricacies of it. But basically, you know, he had some able prime ministers, but he would, you know, not give them the full authority to implement things. And then when World War I broke out, he sort of suspended everything. You know, he put everybody on suspension to deal with this chaotic war at their doorstep, which was really the worst decision he could have made. Because he basically, you know, he hogtied his own country. And as we know, the Germans pummeled Russia. So that's where we have the revolution. Eventually, enough was enough. I mean, Nicholas had a series of really disastrous engagements in war before the revolution that, you know, should have sort of woken him up to the fact that this just wasn't his forte. But he simply, you know, he wanted to uphold the Romanov tradition. He wanted to be seen as a czar like his father. And I think that really clashed with the reality of the situation. In many ways, I think he was a good man. He was just a really bad ruler.
Right, and certainly unequal to the peculiar tasks and challenges that faced him at this point. A last quick question. It's very clear as we read this novel, first of all, that Maria Feodorovna lived through so much, saw so much of the world change in such drastic and dramatic ways. There is no question, the way you have crafted this, that you see her as a largely admirable figure. We come away admiring her in so many ways, even if we don't necessarily agree with every single thing she did or every single word she spoke. Was that, in a sense, a very conscious decision on your part to craft her in this way?
That's interesting. That's an interesting question. You know, I write in the first person. I write in the character's point of view. So all the time I'm very conscious when I'm writing a novel that it's not about me. It's not about the moment I start judging my character, it's no longer about the character, it's about my judgment of the character. So what I try to do is really slip into the skin and think about how would Maria have seen this? I didn't set out to craft a novel where none of my novels are set out to craft stories of heroines. These are fallible human beings. They're flesh and blood. They're complicated. They make mistakes. They've got good qualities and bad qualities. And Maria certainly had her share. She could be very controlling of her family. She could be very petty with Alexandra. There's several incidents in the novel that show behavior that I found quite beneath her, to be frank, and unnecessary, where she sowed more dissension with her daughter-in-law than there might have been otherwise if she had just chosen to behave differently. But I think her efforts are underappreciated. I think she's been largely forgotten. We tend to have mythologized the last Romanovs to such an extent, and rightfully so due to their martyrdom, that we see them in this very sort of pink light. And we forget that these, again, were human beings, fallible human beings, despite their horrible end. They had their good qualities and their bad qualities. So what I wanted to really set out to do was to portray a human, a person behind the name with Maria, and sort of highlight who she was, who I think she was.
C.W. Gortner's latest historic novel is titled The Romanov Empress, a novel of Tsarina Maria Feodorovna, published by Ballantine Books. If you want to know more about the Romanovs, you can go to the WGTD Morning Show archives and find July 10th, 2018, for my conversation with Helen Rappaport, the author of The Race to Save the Romanovs. And from last year, May 24th, 2017, you can hear my conversation with Simon Sebag Montefiore, whose book is titled The Romanoffs, 1613 to 1918. I'm Gregory Berg.
And we're approaching